it's not important about what's happened to me as much as what God's done for me. And I'm here tonight really to share my life's lessons that have been shared with me, and I'm sure by those who shared them with me, they would give credit to other people as well. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. Very good to be with you here tonight. I've heard about this retreat from my friend Elmer, and he invited me to come down here. Said, man, you ought to come down here. And I told him I was going to come, and the next thing I know, Skylar was inviting me to come down here and do this. So it's just good to meet you all. The thing I love about AA is how you just make instantaneous friends. And it's the common denominator. We don't have to know each other to know where we came from, and we don't have to know each other to know what's happened. And the reality of what we're like now, it's just what God is doing daily with us. But let me tell you what I want to do tonight. I want to share my story with you so you can get acquainted with me. And so the rest of this weekend, and when I get finished, I'm going to talk about the weekend, but I want to share with you about where we're going. And it's my story. I'm not going to get into the details of a drunkologue. I just want to give like a 30,000 feet view of what God delivered and brought me out of, and how he did that, and then the new life that he's given me to live today, that as those folks wrote so eloquently, it grows increasingly more wonderful as time passes, as it goes by. I owe everything I have that's of any good to God. And that's not just a cliche, although it's a verse in the first chapter of James, but it's truth. Everything that I have that's of any good at all has come from God. And he's been so generous and kind and merciful to me. And the amazing thing is he will meet anybody who will look for him. Anybody. And that's powerful. That's powerful. Well, Let me share this with you. I'm 63 years old, and I live down in Columbia, Tennessee with my wife. Beverly was kind enough to come with me, and she's the woman of my dreams. And I met her 30 years ago when I moved to Nashville. I moved to Nashville to write songs. I think everybody moves to Nashville to write songs. But also, I have been in the healthcare business for some time. And have been kind of successful, and but more about that later. She and I got married. We met in 1985. We got married in 1987. We have three daughters: 25, 23, and 22. Right? Pretty good, huh? Okay. And they all three still live at home, and our middle daughter is getting ready to get married. And, well, actually, she's not getting ready to. She just announced, sprung it on us. Can you imagine that? Actually, the guy called me up to ask if he could marry. He called to make an appointment with me. So, to see if he could marry my daughter, which is the right way to do things. You know, that's the way, that's doing it by the book. So of course, I didn't ever want any of them to get married, but if they got to get married, I'd like for them to meet a nice guy and get married to a nice guy. And you got to have, it's nice if your children are married, if they give you grandchildren. But you can't, there's not a whole lot you can do about stuff like that. You know, you have kids, you raise them, and you turn them over to God if you're wise, and things turn out the way they're going to. So, and then you just got to kind of adjust to it. Be flexible enough to take what God gives you and make the best of it. But anyway, I'm thankful for Beth for coming down with me this weekend. And we're both very, very glad to be here. I'm 63 years old. I had a middle class upbringing in Kansas City. which is a metropolitan area of about 1.5 million people. And any Kansas City Royals fans out there, thank you very much. Won the World Series a couple of weeks ago. I've been celebrating ever since. It'd been 30 years since Kansas City had won everything, anything. So, but I was one of five children. I was the oldest of three. I've got three brothers and a sister. And I have no excuses, none, for the choices that I made. I did not have a bad upbringing. Nobody to blame it on. I just made some choice. I'm very independent, very strong-minded, strong-willed child. And as soon as I got a bicycle, nobody knew what I was doing anymore or where I was. So things got different quick. I was raised Catholic, and I was very, very, very religious as a little kid. And I went to Mass every day as a little kid from the time I was about in first grade until I left eighth grade. I went all year round, walked, rain, sleet, snow, very religious. And then I smoked my first cigarette. And my two best friends presented it to me. And the peer pressure was too overwhelming for me. No, it was. I wasn't strong enough to stand up to them. I was so shocked. I had no idea either of them had started smoking. And we had done everything together. I played sports and played music, and my whole life revolved around that and God. And then all of a sudden, here's this cigarette, and I got to choose whether I'm going to be friends with these guys anymore. And I smoked the cigarette. And my life has never been the same since. Oh, my gosh. And the cigarettes were the hardest thing for me to quit. Oh, my. I'll talk about that later. But I had opened a door in my life that it became easier for me to open up other doors. And what the cigarette smoking did, really, it made me have to start hiding my behavior. And I started lying. And so it separated me from my parents. It separated me from my brothers and my sister. And most importantly of all, and I never realized this till 7 years sober, it separated me from God. And the favor that I had enjoyed all that time, I didn't realize it at the time, but it wasn't there anymore the way it had been. It had nothing to do about anything God had done. It was me who turned my back and in this way had walked away. So I barely graduated from high school. I was a really successful in football and baseball. And had scholarship offers to college, and by the time I left home in the middle of my senior year, things got bad quick for me, and I was an alcoholic in high school, and began doing other kinds of drugs, and I decided not to go to college, and I got involved in criminal activity. And the summer after I graduated, I went into a warehouse one night to collect some money that was owed me, and I got shot by a ricochet bullet, and I thought I'd just been shot, and I went down in my leg. I had it hit me in the calf of my leg, and I thought I was going to die, and it was really dramatic. And so I called some people that I was associated with at the time, and they this was before they had the doc in a boxes, so they really had to get a hold of some folks to get a doctor at midnight that would work out of his garage, if you know what I mean. And so I made a decision that night, I'm going to college. I'm not cut out for this stuff. This is a little bit too rough for me. So one of the lesser schools that had offered me a scholarship was still interested in me going. They let me go down there, and so I played a year of football with them, and I got kicked out. They wouldn't let me come back. So it left me looking for another college, and there was another college that wanted me to play and play football and baseball, and I did. And I lasted there 2 years, and they kicked me out. They wouldn't let me come back. And without going into a lot of detail, it was bad. It was my behavior. So I was very bitter and resentful. I was totally incapable of taking any responsibility for my life and the things that happened. It was blaming people, places, and things. And the thing that I've learned is our alcoholism has nothing to do with what we drink or when we start drinking or how much we drink or where we drink or who we drink with or why we drink. What matters is what happens to you when you drink. And trouble happens to me when I drink. And what it becomes is a battle to see how much pain you can endure and what have you got left that you're willing to lose. Because that's what it's costing you when you're drinking as an alcoholic. And so I just continued to drink, and I went back to crime because I couldn't hold a job. I became a very violent criminal and really got in with some bad people. And it's you talk about fearing for your life. I wasn't scared of dying. I was scared of going to hell. And dying would have been a relief, but it was the going to hell part that just scared me to death. I really did. I mean, if you grew up as a little kid as a Catholic, one thing they'll do, the nuns, will scare Jesus right into you. Now you may leave him, but that guilt doesn't go away. Miraculous set of situations, circumstances. I had people looking to kill me, and me dying, going to hell was a very realistic thing that was going to happen. And I found out about a guy, fellow musician, who I knew of, and I was outside of a club, and I was playing music at this place, and I was out in the back in the parking lot on break drinking. Imagine that. And she walked out there, walked up to the car, and I asked her if she wanted some, and she said no, but I wanted to tell you my husband used to drink like you do. And I started laughing. I said, what do you mean he used to drink like I do? If you drink like I do, you drink. He said no, he's quit. He hadn't drank for over 2 years. And I was laughing. No, yeah, right. The following Monday night, I walked to his house in a blizzard. And I took a case of beer with me. I didn't want to get a DUI. And I thought, me drinking a blizzard, there's a real high possibility of me getting pulled over. So I walked. And he was having a band rehearsal, but he interrupted and left his bandmates to tell me about how he got sober. And you talk about being gracious. I arrived there about 10 o'clock at night. And he talked with me from about 10 that night to about 6 in that morning. And he told me his story about how he had found Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me about his dad, who was 11 years sober, and that his dad had introduced him to the group of AA there in Kansas City. And he said, we're playing tomorrow night, but I'll get my dad to take you to a meeting. And I said, okay. And it was January 18th, 1976, and it was the last drink I've ever had. 4 days later, I'm a speaker at a speaker meeting. So You know, it got back quickly at AA too. I hated God. I blamed. Have you ever got to the point where you blamed every person, place, and thing you can blame, and you run out and you're still having trouble? Oh, okay, so now you got to blame God. There's nothing else big enough. And so not only did I blame him, but I was raging at God inside of myself. And so I walk into my first AA meeting, and it's with this guy's dad who would become my first sponsor. And I see all this God stuff. They had those steps and traditions, you know, on those big posters. And so I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, and I had asked this guy some really intense questions the night before. I was doing my due diligence. And the first thing I asked him, I said, "What's it cost to go to this deal?" And he said, "Nothing." He said, "There's no dues or fees for AA membership." What? Who's in charge? Whose rear end do you got to kiss? Whose ring? He said, "There are no leaders." What? How long do you got to go? Oh, they don't care if you go or not. He had me hooked. I mean, seriously, I had to go the next night just to, what kind of an unorganized organization is this deal? And how could anything this crazy, how could it actually work? So I went to a meeting, and I decided I was going to do everything I could, because I didn't think this was going to work for me. And really, the only reason I was going was to prove to myself it wouldn't work. So when I died, at least I'd have the peace of knowing I tried everything I could, and it just wasn't meant for me to be. And it worked. They were pointing out the important people at the AA club to me that evening. John O'Neill, who was my first sponsor, he dumped me on somebody else because I guess he didn't want to be seen hanging out with me. I was that much of an undesirable-looking character. So this kind person was showing, oh, this guy's got 20 years. Oh, he's got 15 years, and he's got 11 years, and oh, the guy over there in the special chair, that's Charlie Miller. Charlie's got 35 years, and he said this like it was the proudest thing in his world. And I'm looking at Charlie, and Charlie looked like he was asleep. He looked like a stuffed animal, you know. And I'm thinking, what the heck? This guy, what kind of a loser is this? He hasn't drank for 35 years, and he's hanging out with somebody like me? Are you kidding? None of this made sense to me at all. I couldn't get it. And I prided myself on being real alert, real with it, figuring people and things out quickly. And this AA thing tore me up because I couldn't figure anything out. And I looked at that literature, the 12 steps and 12 traditions, and I saw all the God stuff. This can't work. I hate God. I can't do this God stuff. And as I was looking around, I saw this little guy with long hair. He had long hair like I did, and I thought, oh, they didn't tell me how long that guy has. So I said, "See that guy over there? How long has he been here?" "Oh, you don't want to talk to him. He's only got about 6 weeks." I ran to where that guy was. No, that was the guy I wanted to talk to. See, I wasn't down there to stay sober for 20 years or 35 years. How the heck do I get to my house tonight without drinking? That's what I need to know. And I asked this guy, his name was Tim, And I said, I hear you've been sober 6 weeks. And he says, that's right. That's right. I said, well, how'd you do it? And he said, I go to a meeting every night. And I don't drink in between the meetings. Oh, I about collapsed. Whoa! That's the most intelligent thing I have ever heard in my entire life. I mean, this guy gave me directions that I could follow that would work for a lifetime. Go to a meeting every night and don't drink in between the meetings. I was in wonderment. By that time, it was time to start the meeting, and I was just sitting there, and I was just going, go to a meeting every night. Don't drink in between the meetings. So I decided these steps and stuff aren't really for me. They're for these nice people that come here. I'm just going to go to the meeting and not drink in between the meetings. And so they were saying things like, if you hang out in the barbershop, you're going to get a haircut. And I'm going, okay, who cares, man? And oh, don't go to places where they're drinking. Well, as soon as the meeting's over, I'm going to the club. What do you mean don't go where they're? What do you mean don't go? Are you crazy? So I did everything you aren't supposed to do. And yet, I wouldn't recommend this to anybody. God kept me sober through living this insanely. But one thing I learned out of it, this program is so powerful that if all you do is go to a meeting and don't drink, it'll work. It'll work. Now, you may not be happy, joyous, and free, and you may not have the promises, and you may not get, you know, the turkey and the trimming, but you can go without drinking. And that's all I wanted from AA. I didn't want what they had. Didn't know what they had. And I was looking at them and said, I don't want to be like that. They don't look cool. They don't sound cool. I don't want to be like this. And I was the youngest person in our group at the time by about 4 or 5 years. And I was excited. Friday night was a young people's meeting. And so I was going to go, and then Gail C., Elmer, you know Gail. He's the guy that took me to that, had me speak 4 days sober. Oh, the next Friday, after my speaker meeting appearance, I went to the young person's meeting. Are you kidding me? I mean, there are people in their 40s and 50s. I go, my gosh, young people's meeting. Oh, this is sad. This is very sad. Well, I kept going to meetings. I hated being sober. No, I hated sobriety. Couldn't stand it. No, I'm serious. I was miserable. Miserable. I was so miserable. I would go to bed every night, and my mind would just be racing. And I couldn't do anything to turn it off. Well, here's something I found out is, see, I'd never drank coffee before in my life. You know? And so I've quit drinking alcohol, and so like I get up about noon every day, right? And so I'm having my life support. I'm having cigarettes, and you know but instead of having my first drink, you know, okay, I'm going to drink some of that coffee. I'm going to drink coffee, and I'm going to drink tea. And so from the time I'd get up till I'd go to bed, I'm drinking coffee and tea all day. And my mind's racing, and my teeth are grinding, and my eyeballs are, you know, that wide. And I don't know why it's so hard to go to sleep. I can't understand it. And this was back in the day. This was before they had medication. You know what I mean? No, I'm serious. If you had a psychiatric disorder back in those days, they had this stuff called Thorazine. And so if you went to the mental place, I call it the nut house. They call it the mental facility. And so if you went there, they'd give you Thorazine. It didn't matter what you had. You have anxiety, you're getting Thorazine. You're depressed, you're getting Thorazine. And later on, I figured out, well, they give everybody Thorazine, so they don't have any patient management problems. Everybody just walks around, as long as I'm the right way, yeah. So there wasn't a lot of information about alcoholism. Nancy Reagan was still a movie star. She hadn't had her Just Say No thing yet. And, Mrs. Ford hadn't come out of the closet yet. And all these wonderful things that would happen and reduce stigma and create awareness and information out there, it just wasn't out there. There wasn't any DARE program or, the cops coming to the school to scare the little children and, none of that. None of that. So I'm learning about alcoholism at these meetings, and 1 hour sound bites. And I'm listening to all these people talk about this stuff. I remember there was a lady named, I hated Harriet. And Harriet was a whiner, okay? Harriet would say this, "Hi, I'm Harriet, I'm an alcoholic, and I burned my daughter's birthday cake, so I came to AA." I said, "You did what? You quit drinking over a birthday cake? Are you kidding me?" And so I'm thinking, what am I doing here with these people? Go to a meeting, don't drink in between the meetings. So I'm doing that, but I'm wanting to drink all day, every day. I have that mental obsession. Don't know it's a mental obsession because I have never opened the book. No idea. I mean, I explained it in there. The great idea of every abnormal drinker is someday, somehow, I'd be able to control and enjoy his drinking. And many of us going to the gates of insanity or death. And it'd be years before I would figure that out. I would pray every night before I go to bed for God to kill me in my sleep. And that way I wouldn't have to face the misery and I wouldn't have to deal with God and suicide. And I might some way, somehow, not go to hell. And I experienced in September 1976 the greatest miracle I've ever experienced in my entire life. And I woke up one day and I realized I hadn't thought about drinking for a couple of days. And immediately a couple of things happened. One, all my rage at God went away. And I had this intuitive thought that God had taken away the desire to drink. Just like these people at those meetings had been claiming it happened for them. And I thought, no, they don't like it the way I like it. They don't drink the way I drink. But they did. And God had done that for them. And my refusal to believe the truth didn't make the truth any more or less real. The truth is the truth. And I knew God had taken my desire to drink, and it was the greatest thing, bar none, that has ever happened to me in my whole life, to be relieved, delivered, and set free from the bondage of mentally obsessing over alcohol. And God, I take time tonight to thank you for doing that for me, for every alcoholic who no longer suffers from that. I tried to think of what can I do to be successful, and I all of a sudden I had the intuitive thought of go back to college and finish what you started. I called back the school that had kicked me out, and they let me come back. Very gracious. I told them what I'd done. I told them I was an alcoholic, drug addict when I was up there, and I'm sorry for everything that I had done, and asked them to give me another chance, and they did. I got my scholarship back to play football and baseball. It took me 2 years to graduate. It took me a decade to get a four-year degree, and but I finally had finished something in my life I'd started, and I went back to Kansas City after I graduated, and I got right back into crime. I'd been doing crime the whole time I was sober, but I got out of it when I went to school. But it just, the money was, I was addicted to the money, the easy money of it. And I committed my last act of violence on September 1st, 1979. And there were a lot of complications because of what happened that night. And it took me until July of the following, in 1980, to get all of those things behind me. But I moved to California, and it's one of those things that I needed to do. And I just could not escape the things I was caught up in. And literally moving across the country was the right thing for me to do then. And I got my newly minted diploma, and I went to work for a healthcare company out there. And I plugged into meetings, but I had the same kind of thing. I'm going to a meeting every day, not drinking in between the meetings. That's my deal. But when I was delivered from the addiction, from the mental obsession, I started opening up my mind to God. And I started seeking God intentionally on purpose. And I tried everything from Zen Buddhism to New Age. Everything. Back then, they didn't have the internet, so you had to either go to a library or buy books. And so, anybody ever see, there used to be a TV show in the 70s called Kung Fu. And there was this, you know, real spiritual Eastern Shaolin priest who immigrated to the United States and wandered around the Old West being very peaceful until somebody upset him. And then he'd beat him up. And I thought, I'm going to give this a try. So I went out and bought me a book on Zen Buddhism. And you think the Bible's hard to read. I'm telling you what. This was ridiculous. I mean, I took a couple of paragraphs into it, and I thought, I need to smoke some pot to understand what they're saying in this thing. And no, you can't smoke pot either. So that was my Zen Buddhism. But I ended up getting in this New Age stuff, and it almost took me out. It almost took me out. Basically, what I was doing is I translated that line in the third step where it says, God of your understanding, and I translated that to mean God of my own invention. So I invented a higher power for myself. And here's what he became. It was, God had the power to keep me sober and let me do whatever else I wanted to do. Isn't that sweet? And I started reading all of these books about mind science and stuff and the power of positive thinking, and I became my own God. And I got everything that I had ever wanted in my entire life. Everything. Money, I mean everything. I could go anywhere I wanted, do whatever I wanted to do. And I was more miserable than I had ever been in my entire life. And I hadn't had a drink or a drug for 7 years. And I had nothing to blame it on. I was miserable. I couldn't tell anybody. What are you going to do? Go down to the AA club and you got 7 years and I hate myself. What? How can you hate yourself? You got all this. You got all that. I hated myself. I was sitting on my couch one night. I had a guitar. And this is back in the days. I know some of you are too young to remember this, but they used to have TVs with no clicker. Yeah, and there were only six channels. There was ABC, CBS, NBC, and then they had this new one, CNN, ESPN, sports, and then they had MTV, you know, but no clicker. And so if your TV was on the other side of the room like mine was, I'm too lazy to get up and change channels. I just barely had the sound to where you could hear it. And I would never watch a show like this, but they had this Christian TV show on called The 700 Club. And so I'm all of a sudden, I start paying attention. And this is not the kind of thing I would watch. And I had this host on there named Pat. And Pat had a guest. And the guest was this just really successful businessman who was telling his story. And there wasn't any alcohol or drugs, but he was telling a story of being so miserable. And he hated himself. And he prayed a prayer and asked God to come into his life. Asked Jesus to come into his life. And then Pat said, now in just a minute, we're going to pray that prayer. And if you're watching at home and you want to pray that prayer with us, you go right ahead. And so I'm thinking there, what have I got to lose? Nobody's going to know I did this. And I'm thinking, I'm going to take this for a test drive. No, I'm going to try this for a couple of weeks. And if my life gets better, I'll keep doing it. And if not, I'm never going to tell anybody I did anything like this. So I prayed to prayer. And I'm waiting. You know, Bill Wilson saw lights, and, you know, this happened, and I didn't have anything like that happen. But I started feeling better. And I had no reason to. I mean, I should have been having a great life and enjoying every second of it, and I hate it. And now all of a sudden I'm not feeling that way. And so I don't know why. I don't know what's happened to me. All I know is the only thing different I did was to pray that prayer. So I became a Christian that night. And just as my life had been changing from the time I quit drinking and using, my life began to change. After making that decision, what I did, this was a life-changing thing. I made a decision to work the 12 steps with Jesus Christ as my higher power. And that's what I did. I went back at step one, started, did all of them, 1 through 12, in about a 90-day, 120-day period of time. And it transformed and changed my life totally and completely. I mean totally and completely. Everything in me and around me changed. And I wouldn't have believed it except it was my experience. If somebody else would have told me, oh, this is what I did, I'd be like, yeah, right, okay. You believe in the Easter Bunny too, don't you? But this is what happened. And my life has never been the same since. And so for the past 33 years, almost 33 years, I have been living my spiritual life as a Christian. I was living out in California until 1985. I moved to Nashville, and I met my wife Beverly at church up there, and we got married about a year and a half later. What I have been doing in the healthcare business is I work for a company that owned about 60 treatment centers. I'd worked my way up. My original sponsor died. The sponsor I have now, I've had for 37 years. And I talk to him every day. And he was my mentor in the healthcare business. And the company owned psychiatric hospitals and med-surgical hospitals. But I ended up starting out one of their alcohol and drug treatment facilities. And it wasn't because I was an alcoholic or an addict, it's just where they put me to start. And I saw what they were doing there, and I was keenly interested. And I saw people getting better. And I thought, okay. And see, I'd been anti-treatment centers. There weren't any treatment centers when I got sober where I was living. I was sober about 6 weeks before I even heard there was a treatment center. And some guy came in the meeting one night and said, "Hey, I'm Billy, and I just got out of treatment today." And I turned to the guy next to me and I said, "What's treatment?" And he said, "Oh, man, are you kidding? They got dope, women, volleyball. It's wonderful." And I'm thinking, what am I doing here with these people? And then that thing came in my, go to a meeting every night. Don't drink in between the meetings. You have all the story you need right now. So I ended up going back to graduate school and got my license as a counselor. But I managed treatment programs and treatment centers and psychiatric facilities, and God bless me in learning how to do that. And when I moved to Nashville, I ended up going down to Columbia, Tennessee, and helping to open a small alcohol and drug treatment center down there in the Med-Surg Hospital and a psychiatric unit. And 8 years into it, they came to us and they told us, "Hey, y'all have done great, but we can make more money doing something else with your beds." So it left us with nowhere to do what we were doing. By now, I'd been a Christian, I don't know, from 1983 to 1995. 1996, they came and told us this. And I had been being mentored by my pastor for ministry. And that same voice that was inside of me that told me, "You got to get sober now. We aren't going to make it." That same power that put that woman in that parking lot that night and gave me favor with her husband to tell me about the program, and the same voice that told me to move to California and watch that TV show and move to Nashville, that same voice told me to take everything I was doing and turn it into a nonprofit ministry. And I did. I did. I went home that night that God told me to do that and told my wife Beverly what I thought I'd heard God say. Now, it's one thing for you to believe God told you to do something. It's another thing to go home and tell somebody else what God... It would be like Moses going to the house and saying, "Well, you'll never guess what happened today. I was out there on the backside of the desert, you know, with the sheep. And this burning bush, you'll never believe it. It was on fire, but nothing burned up. And I heard this voice talking out of it, and the voice told me to go get the Jews." tell them it's time to leave Egypt. I'm so blessed that God had given me someone to be my life partner who believes in God and is willing to be obedient to God to do whatever He wants her to do. It's life and death for me and people like you. Our life depends on it, and we know that. If we stay clean and sober this long, we get to the part where if we don't do what God wants us to do, there's no power. And you just don't last very long without the power. So we decided to start the Place of Hope, which is it's a Christ-centered, non-denominational alcohol and drug treatment center and homeless shelter for people that don't have any money or any insurance. We take people with money and insurance, but we don't take their money or insurance. And it's very disarming for people to come to a place and not have to pay anything, because it lets them know that we have no motive to help them other than we want to help them. And so we do not try to force any denominational theology or religious doctrine on anybody. But we have some church services, and I teach from the Bible. And it's just, it's a Christ-centered approach to recovery. And it's just what God has taught me and shared with me. And I tell everybody that comes in, you don't believe anything I say. And gosh, that's a wonderful thing to tell people, because it really takes the burden off. And it's like I would tell you tonight, one of the reasons that I enjoy being, because you don't have to believe anything I say. And I tell people, it's like a buffet table. They told me, take what you want and leave what you don't. So Bev and I have been blessed. The Place of Hope, it opened in April of 2000. It's been open for, it'll be 16 years. And we've had several thousand people come in and go through the program. Many people staying clean and sober, day at a time. One of the things God told us to do was, how are you going to do this? And miracle after miracle after miracle. We've been given a 40,000 square foot building, given. In 1993, an appraisal was done on it because the man who bought it, it was part of five facilities he was buying. And in 1993, the property and building was valued at $3.4 million. And so I don't know what that would be in today's market, but a lot more than we could come up with. Let me just put it that way. So what I've seen over my years of doing this is God doing miracle after miracle after miracle to keep our doors open and to provide this safe place. We go on the streets of Nashville every other Friday night and try to minister to the homeless. We take sack lunches and cold drinks and clothes and sleeping bags and coats and backpacks, things that are practical for folks like that. We play live, loud music, to draw a crowd, and our vans go out through the inner city. If we get people who are alcoholics and addicts, people who are mentally ill, people who are both, people who just don't want to work, there are all kinds of folks on the street. But the reality in the world that you and I are living in tonight in our country, and I'm so thankful to be an American. This is the greatest country on this earth. God has blessed this country. And we're the wealthiest country there is in the history of this world. But there are so many of us in this country who are a couple of paychecks away. If we miss a couple of paychecks, we'd be in big trouble. And there are a lot of people, if they didn't have families or friends whose couches they could go, they'd be on the street too. And more of this is happening. So it's been a shelter for people who have nowhere to go. Well, that's what I want to share about my story tonight. That kind of brings you up to date to where I am. And as we talk over these next few days, I'll kind of fill in some more details where I think it'll illustrate a point that God, I think, is wanting to make. But one of the things that I want to share with you tonight is it's not my intent or purpose to repeat or rehash the big book or the 12 steps, 12 traditions, or AA comes of age, or Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, or As Bill Sees It. Those, you've read those books, and if you haven't, you can read them. I'll leave those kind of recountings to other folks. But I want to share my experience and my strength and my observations from the journey where God has taken me in my own personal healing. And because the amazing thing, the greatest thing I would tell you, besides Him rescuing me, saving my life, keeping me from going to hell, and letting me live these past 39 years, the greatest thing I can tell you is what He did for me, He'll do for anybody else. And the crazy thing was I wasn't even doing this stuff. And He still did it for me. There's a powerful line in that book. Sometimes I think it gets overlooked. Because down here in the Southeast, we have this custom where we read the opening pages of chapter 5, how it works, before every meeting, you know? And to be honest with you, I think we hear it so often that a lot of times the truth and the power from the truth kind of goes right by us because we're getting our coffee together and we're finishing up the conversation on the front porch, or we're going to the bathroom, or we're on our way because we're timing it, so we get there almost when the reading's over with. And because hey, we've heard this over and over and over. But it says no human power could have relieved us of our alcoholism. And God could and would if He was looked for, sought. Not if He was found. Not if you become a Christian. Not if you join the church. Not if you start being a good person. But if you'd look for Him. God could and would. And that's what He did. That's what He did. And to think He would not only let me stay sober 7 years hating Him, but He would take away my desire to drink while I'm hating Him and save me like that. Because look, in the old AA hall, I'm sure they've got posters like this other places. I've just never seen it. There's a poster that has this cat just hanging on the side of the wall with its claws. Have you ever seen that? You know, I felt like that cat. I felt like I'm just sliding down the wall, and I can't hold on any longer. And right when that happens, God comes and whoa, he does it. Greatest miracle I've ever seen. And listen, I've seen some miracles. I've seen some crazy miracles in my life, really. Really crazy miracles. But this is the greatest one I've ever seen, heard, witnessed, experienced, known about. Was God taking my desire to drink away from me. That's how profound it was for me. And I think if any alcoholic, if we get to that point of self-honesty, where we can see the truth, and the truth gets a hold of us inside of our heart, it'll overwhelm us and we'll begin that pathway to change. I don't have, nor have I ever had, an original thought in my mind. No, I'm serious. I'm not being self-deprecating. I truly believe that at best we're antennas that thought passes through, and they're God is a source of thought, and then there's these other sources of thought. And what we do is we pick and choose. And so anything I'm saying tonight is either from God or from somebody who heard it from God. So I want to say that. We're going to be talking about making peace with God so you can make peace with yourself, so you can make peace with other people. I devour books. That's one of the things I enjoy doing that relaxes me, and I read all the time. And I've read some incredible literature. Emmett Fox, William James, Albert Ellis, William Glazer, great philosophers, physicians, scientists, religious figures, and all of it has led me to the Bible and the big book. The Bible and the big book. And it doesn't matter what my problem is or what I'm trying to figure out. My answers are in those books. And so a realization, this inward journey to discover who you really are so we can die to it. Because I'm the worst enemy I've ever had in my entire life. Nobody ever did. If anybody would have done one-tenth to me what I did to me, you'd have to get rid of them. And it'd be self-defense. You wouldn't have any choice. But yet we have abused ourselves. And the only way, you can't stop doing that. You have to die to it. And what the 12 steps do, it gives me the tools to begin that process of dying to self. And then to make peace with God. And then at peace with God, I can make peace with myself. See, God doesn't want me to be a dad. He wants my spirit to come alive. He wants to fill me with his spirit and to live his life through me. And that'll be the greatest me I could ever be. And it will, I can't quit being self-centered, but in the moment I'm God-centered, I'm not being self-centered. Does that make sense? And these steps give me a way to do that. To create peace within me and help me to keep my peace. Now, I can't do this perfect. I'm practicing. And I'm practicing not to get perfect. I'm practicing to get better. And I'm better than I used to be. I'm not where God wants me to be, but I'm not where I was. And back in 2000, and I'm going to close with this. In 2001, we were really in a bad place. I mean, it was just day to day, we were just having to pray for the money to come in, to keep the doors open, to buy food, and to keep the lights on and stuff like that. And I'll talk more about this through the weekend as I can relate it to these principles. But I had a stroke on January 5th, 2002. And I had been to the gym. I was in great shape, great physical condition. But I had undiagnosed high blood pressure, did not. And I went to the emergency room. And here's how stupid I am, okay? I was preparing a Sunday school class for the next day. And I'm sitting, I have a little thing in our basement. And my wife and girls had gone shopping, and I'm sitting there, and I dropped my pencil. That's how I picked it up, and I dropped it again. That's strange. I picked it up, and I dropped it again. And then I noticed I was having trouble opening my hand up. And I thought, I must be dehydrated. So I thought, I'm going to go get me some tea. So I go get me a bunch of sweet tea and start drinking it. My wife and girls come home, and by the time they get there, I'm slurring my speech. And my hand's clawed up, and my right leg, I'm dragging it. And it's still, the light bulb still hasn't come on yet, you know? And I let's go to the Outback Steakhouse, you know? And so we're eating, and Beverly, you need to go to the emergency room, you need to go to the emergency room, you need to go to the emergency room. So I'm crawling out to the parking lot. So I said, yeah, I need to go to the emergency room. So we go, and my blood pressure is like 230 over 145. And they told me, they pulled those curtains, and they said, we don't know if you're going to make it. And I was shocked. I was shocked. I didn't feel anything, you know? Didn't see this coming. And I was in intensive care for 4 nights and 5 days. And finally, they came in and said, you're going to be okay. You just need to take lots of blood pressure medicine. So that's another story. But as I was relaxing and thinking about, because one of the things I found out was I was ready to die. I was at peace. But I didn't want to. I had 3 little girls. I wanted to see them grow up. Crazy about their mom. Wanted to get old with her. And the place of hope was struggling, and I wanted to see that through. And I was just so thankful I was going to be okay. And that voice, you know, the one I'm talking about, the one that told me all these things it's told me over these years, it said, I can't use you the way I want to, the way you are. And I was just, whoa. I was as profound in that moment as go to meeting every night, don't drink in between the meetings. God's not finished with any of us. No, how, it doesn't matter how long we're clean, sober. It doesn't matter how long we go to church. It doesn't matter how many times we've worked the steps. It doesn't matter how many people we sponsor. It doesn't matter how many meetings we go to. God's still in a process of doing something with this because he wants us to get better. And getting better for God means getting closer to God. And that's what I believe he wants us to do. I believe he wants us to become so close that we're one. That he's in us and we're in him. But I can't do that my way. It can't be just something I do in the morning, and it can't be just something I do on Sundays, and it can't be something I do, you know, at the Bible study or with my sponsor, with my spiritual group. I got to do this from the time I get up till the time I go to bed. I got to try to practice this. So I think that's about all for tonight. I want to share, tomorrow morning we're going to talk about making peace with God by dying to self. And then tomorrow afternoon we're going to talk about making peace with self through being God-centered. And then tomorrow evening, making peace with people, places, and things, because blessed are the peacemakers. And they're, blessed means blessed. And I like being blessed, don't you? And then finally, on Sunday morning, the Lord willing, a spiritual awakening, the kingdom of God on earth as it is in heaven. I want to thank you for inviting me here to be with you. Thank you for listening. And it's just a pleasure and a privilege to be here with you all. And the other thing I want to tell you is Bev and I, we're going to be hanging out with you. So if you want to talk to us, please talk to us. We're very approachable and friendly. So, and throughout this weekend, I'm going to tell you some things, and I don't have copies of them with me. But Bev, if you'll tell us that you'd like a copy of something I'm talking about, then when we get back to Columbia, we'll have somebody send it to you, okay? All right. Thank you. Skyler, thank you for those nice things you said about me. Good evening, everybody. And I asked for special permission if I could sit down tonight and just relax and talk with you. I hope that's okay. Very privileged to be here with y'all tonight. Don was asking me earlier if I was going to have breaks, and I told him, well, this all depends on if I have to go to the bathroom or not, Don. We'll see how that goes. I hate speaker meetings. I have a natural aversion to them. And the second speaker meeting that I went to, it was a guy named Jack Bailey, who used to have one of the first reality TV shows called Queen for a Day. He was a host of that. This was back in the 50s. And Jack used to get drunk and do his TV show, and he was hilarious. He was fantastic. Probably the greatest AA talk I've ever heard. And then the next year, our group had Father Martin. And so I was really blessed. But the very first speaker meeting that I went to, I was the speaker. And I was 4 days sober. And this new friend of mine took me to the speaker meeting, and I'd never been to one. I just, hey, I want you to go to a meeting with me. Yeah, okay. So we go to the meeting, and I was impressed they had donuts there. And the group I started out with, they didn't have anything except really old coffee. And so he got up there, and he was, hi, everybody, I'm Gail, and I'm an alcoholic, and it's a pleasure to be here at the Overland Park Kansas group tonight, and I want to introduce you to our guest speaker, Mike C. And I had never been to a speaker meeting. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say. So more about that later if I have time. It just left me with an aversion to speaker meetings of all kinds. So, you know, it's funny how God helps you get over those things you don't like or you have difficulty dealing with. And my story is probably not a whole lot different than everybody's story. And it's what's really